His name is Alexis Borsier.
He scoured it with his little tongue.
Since he was a child, he's been raised to consider pop culture as a fine art to be studied, dissected, analyzed, and debated. My name is Ben Spiro. As a teen, I watched the Evil Dead movies in reverse order, and I suggest everyone else in the world do the exact same thing. Together, we're proud to present...
Hyperstrong Miracle Treasure!
Welcome to Hyperstrong Miracle Treasure, the show where two friends take a deep dive into the pop culture grab bag and hurl random implements of entertainment at one another with reckless abandon. So, Borsier, how you holding up?
Fairly well. I do not have a uterus.
Not that I had heard about?
No, and I appreciate you, you know, not prying into my affairs.
It's your personal business. I don't know if the Supreme Court feels that way, but I do.
Yeah, I mean, it's not my personal business from a legal standpoint.
I'm in a very weird place because I have no opinion that can be in any way helpful to anyone. And I see nothing but, you know, anger and rage from every woman I know. And I want to say or do something, and I know everything I say or do is completely unhelpful.
I do actually have a take on that, which is, no, it's just be mad. Be mad. It's you should be angry about this. You just be angry on behalf of people. Be angry for yourself. Be angry for America.
Right.
It's fine.
And that's the thing. It's like I wouldn't be telling anybody that they shouldn't be angry. That's certainly a thing that I wouldn't do.
Oh, no, but there's nothing productive to be said at this point.
Uh-huh.
Right now.
Right.
As of now, there's nothing. It's, you know, the meteor hit is what it came down to. And we've been kvetching about the meteor maybe hitting for a long, long time. And it just did.
And all of a sudden, I feel like I'm right back where we were after Jacob Blake and all the BLM marches and everything. Like we're right back there at that moment of knowing that there's something incredibly messed up going on and having no direct way to affect it whatsoever, except gathering together in groups and saying, look at this terrible thing.
You know, I did my share of marching in the last week. It both felt better than it has in the past. It felt a little more cohesive.
Mm-hmm.
But it also felt worse in that I think the certainty that change was not going to come from any of this
right
permeated a little more.
It is a gathering together of people to express our displeasure that abortion rights have been taken away. But beyond that...
Me too. And it is very familiar. It's very familiar in the last couple of years. It's certainly since Trump. It's very, very familiar. And at least for me, the only saving grace I'm getting, and it's definitely personal, is that it's real. Is that it is not an overstatement. It is not some confusion drummed up by people with an axe to grind. So I guess that's my only advice, is that, and it is advice, that people understand that, no, their beat on this is entirely accurate and reasonable, even if that beat is to get really, really angry. Really, really angry.
And I feel stupid putting energy into, I mean, I love our podcast. It's just like, what can we put out into the world other than distraction for an hour, right? And I...
Pretty much nothing.
Right? And that's another powerless feeling.
Yeah, but we're people. And it's the particularly hollow part when people say that they aren't political. Sometimes something is big and obvious and all-encompassing. And then, you know what? If you have a dumb podcast with your buddy where you talk about movies, mm-hmm. Well, some people listen to that. So, should probably say something there, too. And then wait for a plan.
It all had to be mentioned. The ruling on Roe v. Wade had to be addressed in some way, and I guess we're going to give the only thing that I can think to give is something hopefully mildly entertaining for a little bit that is not related to that.
Yeah. Hellraiser 3 was a very bad movie.
Huh.
Come enjoy this very bad movie with us.
Last week we watched Boursier's side of the Star Trek / Hellraiser run the franchise battle by going on an intergalactic search for Spock in Leonard Nimoy's aptly titled directorial debut, Star Trek III, The Search for Spock.
They found him.
But this week it's my turn, and I'm forced by my utter psychological inability to abandon a premise, no matter how sweaty or self-destructive, to share the third movie in the Hellraiser franchise. I don't want to do it. I'm not proud of it. But, Boursier and podcasting audience, I am forced to share a film with you that I actively dislike.
This is what it's like to be friends with Robert McNamara. Because you still like him. But you know the things that he's done. And you know what he knew when he knew it.
Benjamin, what's the movie that you've made me watch today?
Oh, my friend. Oh, my kind, patient, understanding friend. I just made you watch 1992's Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth. But before we can truly understand this film, we have to journey back a little further in the past to the year 1990. The first two Hellraiser films were relatively profitable. But when the production company behind Young Guns, Dead Ringers, and Major League, it's an evocative three movies.
No, that's definitely someone's sophisticated stepfather showing him the ropes.
They released the film Nightbreed, based on a lesser-known Clive Barker novella. The film was met with a general shrug of disdain and disinterest. Clearly, this must mean that the Clive Barker phenomena was DOA. So the producers who found themselves already firmly committed to creating Hellraiser 3 did the only thing they could think of: hire the director of Waxwork, and add as many themed Cenobites as humanly possible. In short, Hell on Earth.
Oh no, there's something much, much, much more provocative that they did to ensure that their film would be the success that they believed it had to be, which is to pay Clive Barker a phenomenal amount of money because he had a pay-or-play deal to keep his name off of Hellraiser 3.
Like, the stink of Clive Barker, who made these better movies beforehand? Like, oh, we gotta scrub that away.
But Nightbreed happened, man. That movie wasn't as good as other movies. That movie had a slightly lackluster performance. So, what they logically did was pay the creator anyway, and pay a huge penalty, so that they could take his name off of it, and then call him back in post-production when they realized they made a horrible, horrible mistake. A horrible, horrible mistake. Clive Barker received his quote for that movie twice.
I just don't know what part of the producer mindset looks at the situation and goes, you know who's the weak link here? The writer of the first movie that was successful and the second movie that, you know, was all right.
I don't think you really understand. Nightbreed made slightly less money than they thought it should.
Yeah, kick him to the curb. He's done.
And Clive Barker directed that movie.
Speaking of the director, this film is directed by Anthony Hickox, who... I've never seen Waxwork. Have you actually watched Waxwork?
I haven't seen Waxwork since I was a kid, but I've seen Waxwork. It's what you think it is.
My understanding is that he's a horror comedy director. Like,
kinda, yeah.
And that does not fit with a Hellraiser vibe, because Hellraiser is not and should not be funny.
No, not at all. There's nothing funny about Hellraiser. Even the things that are amusing because they're so over the top aren't funny because of the Cenobites and the pain-pleasure mix and all that stuff.
Yeah, okay, you know what? I think you've hit on it, because if you're giggling during your S&M scene, then you've ruined your S&M scene.
Yeah, we've all been there.
But that's the thing here. Like, the second you're giggling at a Cenobite, then it's done. It's out.
Then we're done with this whole ordeal. It's like taking Freddy Krueger and throwing him into a California backyard barbecue and having him just stab a bunch of teenagers in broad daylight. It just...
Well, although I will say Nightmare on Elm Street 2 has the benefit of accidentally becoming an iconic gay movie.
Also, A Nightmare on Elm Street 2 has the benefit of at least attempting to be consistent with itself. It sort of thinks it's just going to be the way Freddy Krueger is now. Hellraiser knows full well that it just doesn't matter.
Yeah, it just looks silly when your demon is unleashed on the world, especially when you have like a Pinhead or a Freddy that have their own world, and that's what's scary, is their world is terrifying, and they bring you into it against your will, and then suddenly they're on the street, and you're like, what? No, my friend.
No, because I am scary! Look at my sharp parts! I could getcha! Same with Pinhead. To my mind, the Hellraiser movies, and I've only seen the two, but, you know, I'm aware of horror, have always been about Pinhead stabbing people in a bar because they're... I was going to say because they're bad.
No, not just because they were there, because they were out at a bar. Fun fact, Peter Jackson was asked to direct this movie, and that would have been an experience.
Okay, what's interesting about that is I would never ask Peter Jackson to make Hellraiser 3. However, I would ask Peter Jackson to substitute for any movie where the director of Waxwork had a thought here, and that thought was fucking stupid.
How do you know in your mind when a horror franchise has gone off the rails and lost the plot? Like, what are the signs?
I mean, it's harder without a Spencer's Gifts, but this series didn't belong to Pinhead. This series, Julia is the villain. However, like Steve Urkel before him, people sure did love them some Pinhead.
Famous demon, Steve.
That actually tracks. If you told me Family Matters was a very elaborate Hellraiser spinoff that just got out of hand.
I mean, that's Carl Winslow's personal hell.
That is what I'm saying. It tracks way too well. It's actually almost not funny.
Family members disappear between seasons because it's like a dream. It's not. There's no logic there.
Yeah, no, it's the personal hell of the cop from Die Hard.
Because he killed that kid.
He killed that kid.
He murdered
yeah,
that kid.
Exactly.
I think of, say, not Nightmare on Elm Street 2, because although a bad film, they pull it back somehow. And I think of Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, when I think of, like, oh, this has gone wrong, and it can never be good the way it was again.
But I think we're talking about two different things.
I think what I'm talking about is the moment you sit down and you're embarrassed of the franchise you enjoy.
Yeah, no, and that would be Freddy's Dead. Because there's nothing scary about that Freddy Krueger anymore.
But you're still going through the motions like he's supposed to scare you, and that's the saddest part, I think.
Yeah, but I'll pretend to enjoy something that I've invested in for decades. I mean, it's my way.
This is our personal hell. Let's dive in with both feet. We begin, as all good horror movies do, at an art gallery in New York City. J.P. Monroe enters. He has silly boots, leather jacket, my haircut circa 2003.
That's true.
Basically, he's Bobo Billy from Twin Peaks. He's played by Kevin Bernhardt, who spent a decade on General Hospital, but not a ton else of interest. And he is looking for something shocking and subversive for his downtown club. Weird but true, the strange revolving pillar from the end of Hellbound is now a stone sculpture featuring both the puzzle box and Pinhead embedded inside. Unfortunately, no tiny humping skeleton. It kind of looks cool. The sculpture kind of looks neat.
I guess. I don't know why it's there. You look for a logic, you're like trying to give them an out, and they're just not letting me do it. Because they're being phenomenally lazy.
A man we assume to be the gallery owner sells the sculpture to JP, or maybe he's a homeless man.
Also, he's debatably magic.
Cut across town to where a young TV reporter valiantly attempts to record a story about nothing in particular happening at a hospital. This is Joey Summerskill, played by a woman that Borsier knows very well, Terry Farrell. She plays Commander Jadzia Dax on Deep Space Nine. On Deep Space Nine, I assume she must be.
Yeah.
But she is not great here.
No.
She is bringing nothing to this character. She's got this blank slate thing going on, and it's such a major come down from Ashley Lawrence's Kirstie that it's noticeable.
I mean, also, if you're looking around at the rest of the cast, I could see showing up there and thinking that the vibe was stilted theatrical acting. I know Terry Farrell is at very least a competent actress.
Was it a case of just her finding the right role and then just being in that role where she was not asked to do more than she could?
Yeah, I think it might be that. I mean, the character's interesting because she's had, I think, a dozen lifetimes. But she plays it kind of stoic, but with a little bit of charm. I think it might be a less is more thing. Like, okay, well, yeah, his character's supposed to be like 600, but also 23. I don't know. Just be nice and occasionally flirty, but also occasionally inscrutably Vulcan.
Now, there is another character named Terry in this movie, so I'm going to vote that from now on, for the rest of this podcast, she is Jadzia Dax, and only Jadzia Dax. I have a theory for why her character doesn't work. Unless you have an All the President's Men or a Spotlight or something where the plot is about reporting, I think reporters are used to make an uninteresting character more interesting or force a plot upon them.
Yeah, no. It's like architect or PI. It's an easy out. You don't have to think about it. Like, yeah, it's a thing. That tells you that guy's already, he's got a little money in his pocket.
There is a shorthand for what that character means, and then you don't have to do any actual work with it. So she goes from place to place because she's hunting the story. The only other thing that should be mentioned is that she has her camera operator, Doc, who is Bobo Willie Nelson.
And he is Bobo Willie Nelson.
And the second he leaves with the camera to go away, all hell breaks loose in the ER!
Doctors pulling physical chains off of a dude. Okay, again, I think if there's one thing I have actually established over the course of this series, I'm pretty decent with suspension of disbelief. But, huh? What? Huh? What? I was already bothered by the mattress in 2. But you know what? You gave me a good movie. So, all right, spooky hell stuff. Fine, spooky hell stuff. Okay, I'll let you do it. The reason, the part of the horror movie where nobody rational believes you makes sense is usually because during that part of the horror movie, there's nothing to see. There's no real evidence. And the idea is everybody kind of wants to Occam's razor it. But you now have supernatural chains. They're in a controlled environment. They came from nowhere. This should be it.
There's a whole operating room full of doctors that watched electricity course through them as the saddest little head explosion in the world occurred.
It's the 90s, but there's probably already a couple of video cameras in that ER.
One of the funnier things that happens later is back at work, Jadzia Dax is getting some shit because she didn't have video of it, therefore it doesn't happen. Like, well, they've got the story of several doctors who watched a man randomly implode.
Like, 7 farmers and 1 Air Force guy in 1941 said they saw aliens. We're still talking about that shit. We tend to go, well, it's worth investigating the chains. Well, I mean, it's obviously crazy. Sure, but then why did all these 9 people say it? I don't know. Maybe it's a conspiracy. Maybe it's anything. And he's an editor. Like, oh my God. Like, that's your Pulitzer, dude.
Well, she knows there's a story out there, and this brings her to immediately accost the poor young goth woman who came in with this man whose head exploded and try to get the story from her. She very reasonably runs the hell away because, yeah, she doesn't want to be involved in any of that.
No, this is crazy.
Since we're busy flashing back and forth across town, let's flash back one more time to go visit the Boiler Room, JP's club. Because I will say, this club is the weirdest combination of things that I have ever seen. They're not weird separately, but together they make absolutely no sense. Borsia, do you have a Stefan for me? Are we Stefaning it?
I haven't put it together. Now I'm kind of sad about that. No, okay, not this time. But from now on, if there is ever a club scene in one of these movies, I will write you a Stefan.
A little disappointing, but I'm gonna fight through it.
Alright, hold on.
Yay! Stefan!
Located in an anonymous industrial district of New York City, the Boiler Room. It's got an occult prison. And a quiet restaurant next door with violins, a pillar of souls from a prison,
a live metal band, bar that came out of the movie Cocktail,
a meathead in mesh paneled boxer shorts,
morbid fetus decoration. J.P. Monroe has done it again.
Okay, you know what's great about this bar?
Well, okay, yeah. What's great about the Boiler Room? Oh, there's one more thing about the Boiler Room. The entrance where it just says the Boiler Room on fire, that is just the entrance to the bar in Wayne's World, right? Like, it's just...
Oh, yeah, no. Well, first of all, it's like seven different bars.
Right, so it's seven things. It's huge. JP maybe lives above it.
Someone actually thought about this. That's really what it comes down to. It's for anything else that's going on in this movie. For 92, this is pretty fucking impressive. Someone looked at every weird future bar from, you know, some dystopian sci-fi thing and went, okay, these always kind of suck. They're always, like, just kind of one room. Yeah. And...
No, yeah. This one's going to be huge!
It doesn't make the movie any easier to watch, and it doesn't forgive any of the men, and it was men, responsible for these crimes. However, it was a cool-looking bar. It was like Baked Alaska, but for underwear. Like, it's interesting, and separately it might have been good, but it's the worst way.
I have a question for you.
I'm sorry.
Now, you got to cast your mind back to 1992, when I know you didn't live in New York in 1992, but you just got to imagine, what borough is the Boiler Room in? Because I don't think it's Manhattan, because even in 92, are you really going to get several warehouses full of Manhattan real estate for all this?
Yeah, this is Manhattan, but this is Lower Manhattan.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
It's just somehow below 14th Street. Honestly, a barbed wire baby used to come with every loft apartment.
I've got no question about the decor. Yes, the decor is Lower Manhattan.
I mean, you've seen the Warriors. The 90s weren't the 80s, but they weren't the 2000s.
Getting no help at the Boiler Room, Jadzia Dax returns home, where she has dreams of her father dying in Nam. This is going to be part of some convoluted mythology.
Is it, Ben? Is it going to be part of some convoluted mythology later? Because it definitely fucking wasn't here.
No, and I wanted to point it out, if only to make this comparison. Do you remember when we were watching the first Hellraiser, and we were talking about the weird dream sequence with the feathers and the baby crying in the background in the blazer?
Oh, sure, yeah.
And it seems silly at the time, but when you compare the feather dream sequence from Hellraiser with the Nam dream sequence from Hellraiser 3, all I am is impressed with what Clive Barker was doing with visual flair on the cheap in a genuinely unsettling way. Whereas this movie has period military costumes and a helicopter, and it's just like, I don't care.
The first movie's dream sequence, especially, you know, it's kind of Hellraiser-y and magical somehow, is a product of a director who hasn't really directed for film, and of a limited budget. And this one is a product of, we'll probably get away with it, it's a movie, I can't imagine any of the assholes who want to see Pinhead again won't show up just because we didn't work hard or do any creative stuff.
Using the card that Jadzia Dax gave her in the hospital, Terry wakes the reporter in the middle of the night asking to meet. Terry is played by Paula Marshall, and I genuinely enjoy her performance in this film. She's currently on the TV show Euphoria. You might know her from Sports Night.
Yeah, no, yeah.
You remember the plot line where Josh Molina was dating a porn star?
Yeah, yeah.
Paula Marshall.
That's Sorkin before I knew I was supposed to feel guilty about liking it.
She's got like some flighty, damaged energy.
she's actually having some fun with it. And I you know, if I'm honest, I did notice that. Good for her. No one else is having any fun.
You buy her as a club kid with her own baggage who might drift into an abusive relationship with Bobo Billy from Twin Peaks.
Honestly, this is why actors are cool. They're you know, they're like they're movable part toys that happen to have their own theoretical ideas. and this is where it's just about the actress, because there's nothing there for her. There is nothing there for her to play.
She's got three qualities. She is homeless, she's a smoker, and she doesn't dream. Like, that's it. That's all she's given to do.
Uh-huh.
But she makes the character just so endearing.
Everybody else in this movie is saying the things that were on the pieces of paper that they were given before they were given the job.
She comes to Jadzia Dax's apartment. She gives the vague pieces of exposition that she has, and she's got a stone puzzle box that came from JP's new sculpture.
Yeah, no, and she's doing all this stuff with her eyes. Like, she's a person. She's a fully realized character, but it's in defiance of what this movie is trying to do.
She suddenly becomes Jadzia Dax's roommate, like, almost automatically, and in the morning she's attempting to cook breakfast, and it's the most charming part of the film. It's
again, because she's acting!
Did I sleep through an earthquake?
I thought I'd make breakfast.
Oh, that's really nice of you, Terry. Can I ask, is it always this exploratory?
Oh, I don't know. It's my first time. I'm a kitchen virgin.
And it's just like, oh. They've got an actually good dynamic, and it's the one time I like Jadzia Dax in this movie is when she's interacting with Terry. Like, and I want to see their buddy movie. I don't really want to watch the horror movie that's coming. So anyway, they have breakfast. The movie passes the Bechdel test, if nothing else. And then they go to the gallery where the gigantic stone pinhead statue came from in the first place. But it's been closed for a month!
Bum, bum, bum!
My favorite part is that, like, the whole, but it's been closed the whole time, comes from a beatnik version of Werner Herzog with an angry poodle.
Maybe they're closed today.
Closed every day. Owner's in Hawaii. Been over there about a month.
That's bull. My boyfriend bought something here last week.
Couldn't have.
Are you sure?
Sure. Lived here 20 years. I see everything. Come on, Minnie.
After breaking into the art gallery, they discover the sculpture came from the Chouinard Institute. They find a helpful video of Kirsty, Ashley Lawrence, coming in to deliver some exposition and just giving more personality in the tiny scenes of this video recording than anything else that's happening in this movie. I miss her. I miss her in the films, man.
No, and you should miss her.
Jadzia Dax now knows that demons walk the earth. What a scoop! What a scoop!
This is some Star Trek V level bad.
Back at JP's, he reaches into a hole in the sculpture and gets bitten by a rat. It's the New York art scene for you.
Actually, I think I've seen that show.
Blood flies in the sculpture and is quickly absorbed. Hell is about to raise Borsier. Later, while seducing a blonde lady with a single rose, JP brings her back to the room for some light bondage. I gotta say, the lady that he has sex with is a terrible actress, but I am so glad that she clearly put her foot down and refused to be naked in this film.
Oh no, absolutely. That is what happened. That is 100% what happened. Oh my god, I had that thought too. Well, why?
Yeah, no, because she's doing this the thing where you like you cover yourself with your hands during the sex, but it's just like no, not for Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth.
Well, you said you might be open to some nudity. Like, yeah, you said you'd be making a movie. Look, I need to get my SAG insurance straight for the year, but let's not pretend.
Admittedly, Pinhead shoots out hooks, tears off her skin, and absorbs her into a statue, but she went out with dignity, and I appreciate that.
I mean, it is one of the only deaths I remember in the movie because I was so mad that it's so incomprehensible. It makes no goddamn sense.
No, I don't know why he's being reborn in the statue. I don't understand. Like, but blood did it. Blood and desire.
Send in a spooky guy surrounded by flies, but just don't. And he just says,
"Wait. If you fight his power, you become the pillar."
The end! Done!
I don't think being even lazier would have fixed this thing. I almost accept the air of mystery because it gives your mind something to hang on to a little bit. Like, I don't understand why this is happening, and so at least...
And at the beginning, maybe that would have been okay, but then we saw all those electric supernatural chains that were clearly existing in an objective world. So you know what, air of mystery? Fuck that.
I gotta say, it did kind of amuse me when JP goes,
Jesus Christ!
Not quite.
Not quite.
No, that made me mad. No, that was dumb.
Like, not quite.
No, that was also dumb. No, that was also dumb. That line would have been great, said by Hellraiser 2 Pinhead. I'm not kidding. You would have been like, you know what, you earned it. You earned it with all the other horrors.
You're not impressed by the Pinhead who gets shot and then spits out bullets? I don't know. I still always kind of like Doug Bradley's little speeches about desire and flesh.
He's doing it. I mean,
right? Like, he has no choice. He has nothing he can do except his voice and black contact lenses. That's what he's got to work with, and he's going full seducer devil while trapped inside this stone.
Honestly, even his performance is kind of weak. The first two Hellraisers, they're perfect movies. They're perfect movies, and the second one is a goddamn perfect sequel. It's amazing.
I don't love the second one, but yeah.
And maybe I can only appreciate it so much because I've never seen them before.
Hellraiser, even its flaws, are charming now.
This isn't a movie. It's not a Hellraiser movie. It's not a Clive Barker film.
Back at Jadzia Dax's place, Terry's hanging around, notices the puzzle box. Just before Terry can accidentally summon demons, she gets a call from JP, although how he knows that she is at Jadzia Dax's place is, I don't know, beyond me.
Maybe the pillar told her.
A lot of this movie sucks and is just inexplicable. All right. I find some genuine poignancy in the way Paula Marshall plays Terry as a woman who is sucked back into the orbit of her abusive boyfriend. Now, the abusive boyfriend, terrible actor, and that's all bad.
I mean, I guess. But by this point, it may not even be that anybody's performance is really registering anymore. Because I don't even know what's happening in the movie at this point. I really don't.
Yeah, things get really confusing really fast. She has this moment, and again, I think a genuinely poignant moment, where she tells her abusive ex-boyfriend to go screw, and it seems like she's moved on. And then a call comes for Jadzia Dax about getting a job in Monterey, and feeling abandoned, she runs back to JP. And it's weird because this is one of the things in this movie that doesn't make any damn sense because I don't understand what powers hell has. Like,
hell
can make fake phone calls happen, apparently. Later, there's a fake TV broadcast. Demons control electricity. That's what this movie is talking about.
And can they control everybody or can they only talk to her? I don't think this is some nitpicky stuff to say I don't need consistent rules necessarily, but I do need...
Something.
Because we are dealing with the supernatural. Okay, if you are in a Kroger, and in a Kroger, there is a leopard.
Ah!
You can assume that the leopard is dangerous, that you guys have to get out of the Kroger, the leopard might want to kill you, the leopard might is capable of killing you. You know, like, you're building that out. I don't know if this is a leopard, or if this is one of those play school car things. Big colorful one with a circular top. Nothing has told me that. At all. Does hell control electricity? Is that what we're saying? Because honestly, your having said that, whether seriously or not, was more direct data about this movie than I got at all.
They zapped the guy at the beginning. And they're messing with electronics.
Ooh, hell can control electricity. Okay, there we go. That's part of the rules. Okay.
Poor doomed Terry goes back to JP's. He's a little annoyed that she's so weepy and won't go near the statue so the statue can devour her. He even gives her a come to daddy, but it doesn't work.
Wait, he gave her a come to daddy? Oh, that would have been really poignant with different characters from another movie.
And a different circumstance. And turns out callbacks aren't good if the thing they're in are bad. Turns out it just cheapens the thing that you're calling back to, huh?
When they say, with great power comes great responsibility in that first Suicide Squad movie. really nails it home there.
She knocks him out with some brass knuckles. And then, as she's about to escape being devoured by the statue, Pinhead pulls her back in with conversation. And it's the stupidest part of a pretty stupid movie. That she's escaped her abusive boyfriend's physical clutches, but then a demon talks to her from a statue, and she's like, huh, let's hear this fella out. He makes some interesting points.
It's not that there's not a good reason. There's not any reason.
She should probably run. But instead she feeds JP to the statue.
Well, he was the bad guy, I guess.
As much as the Chouinard stuff from Hellbound I did not particularly enjoy, seeing people turned into Cenobites in this movie is just not functionally scary at all. It does not work.
No, and it's not poignant, it's not scary, it's like watching Cybermen made. You're just like, oh, this shit's happening.
No, it's Doctor Who level.
Yeah, this is a terrible movie, Ben.
You don't have to tell me, dude. I know.
It is not the worst movie we have watched for the podcast. But it's the second worst. It's definitely the second worst movie.
Jadzia Dax has another Vietnam dream, but it merges with a World War I dream, and she gets to talk to Doug Bradley about the plot for a bit. Anyway, Doug Bradley's a ghost.
Whoa!
And he's a demon, and he's given instructions. It doesn't matter.
Well, I'm not sure if it was Stephen King. It may have been a Clive Barker quote himself that said, things are only scarier if you explain them well and present them in open light.
You know what? Here's the thing, because I was thinking about it, and you just made something click for me, all right? It's not the open light that's the problem, because remember what was really cool in Hellraiser 1, how fully lit Pinhead was and the other Cenobites?
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, I mean, he's doing all that rear stuff, but
it's natural light. Mm. Natural light does not look scary.
You're absolutely right.
He was fully lit, but that was intense lighting. Otherworldly lighting.
It's daylight that fucks you up. It's sort of, I feel like, the same thing that we lose when we go to like high frame rate or something. Where it's not that it's worse, it's better. But whatever has allowed me to be, like, along for the ride in a pure kind of mise-en-scene way where it's, hey, only what's here is what matters. It's such a dreamlike state already that just tweaking it a tiny bit, like just that little tiny bit, makes you go, oh, that's a guy in weird fucked up makeup. Oh, that's what it looks like when that man has been covered in makeup by good makeup artists.
Back at the boiler room, it's about to get real. Creepy art begins moving, and all of a sudden, Pinhead.
Shall we begin?
All right. Shall We Begin was awesome.
Yeah, and, you know, and this is, I there's no point in saying this doesn't save the movie because nothing could, but
I mean, if at the end there was a peaceful two-state solution to Israel and Palestine, I'd be okay with it. It would be a good movie then.
I think this is the one moment in the entire film where its badness turns into pure camp for just a little bit.
Absolutely. No, you're not wrong. And it's kind of funny. I forgot that because the movie is so bad that I had automatically slotted it into to wherever I put trauma pictures in my head. And I had already put it on that shelf because it was unrelated to this train wreck of a horror show, boring movie I've seen up until now. Because then, yeah, it does. It goes full camp at the end. And you're just like, oh, all right.
Chains are ripping off fingers and faces.
If this was the crescendo to an otherwise serviceable Hellraiser sequel, this would be the part where I was like, yeah, but at the end they saved it.
Animated booze turns into Pinhead's face and then impales a lady with ice.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
The bartender and the DJ get mutilated ironically. Chains emerge from pool tables and impale patrons. Emergency exits are cruel jokes that drip blood. I mean, I gotta like it.
I almost wonder, I wouldn't be surprised though, this stuff wasn't, or at least its punctuation, wasn't the result of Clive Barker's post-production involvement. Because Barker comes on after shooting, but immediately after shooting, because they already know this picture has problems.
And they're like, just can you make it look scary? He's like, I can't, with this? With this? It's like,
but the polish, or it could just be that these were gifted artisans always doing what they were told, and this was 12 unadulterated minutes of just them doing awesome shit. So
Jadzia Dax, she sees a fake TV broadcast, because again, demons can control electricity, and she gets her cameraman Doc to come down, and then she arrives at the boiler room, and once she gets there, it's basically looks like a haunted house. And I have to say, there's nothing in this movie that impresses me except when she walks into the boiler room, and it's just impressively full of corpses. There's so many people, all done in full death makeup, filling all this space. And it's basically like someone went full Halloween Superstore in the makeup department, right? Like CDs impaling people's heads and mouths full of billiard balls. It's just the makeup department ran wild for this one set piece.
Like, I now have just enough experience in the universe of the making of the television and the film to realize that some of the cooler stuff there was probably literally on the day stuff. Like, where they're just throwing things at people and just now, going, I don't know.
we got to fill all this space. What kind of little makeup prosthetic do you have? I don't know. Just like their faces sliced in half. Okay, got it. Do it.
Just put it on. we'll figure something out.
She finds Doc mutilated with a video camera for a head. I don't know. And then Pinhead talks a bunch.
Oh, it's unbearable, isn't it? The suffering of strangers. The agony of friends. There is a secret song at the center of the world. And its sound is like razors through flesh.
I don't believe you.
Oh, come. Oh, you can hear its faint echo right now. I'm here to turn up the volume. To press the stinking face of humanity into the dark blood of its own secret heart.
And I'm here to stop you and send you back to hell.
I don't like this Pinhead one.
I always enjoy his voice. And I can accept that what we're basically hearing here is Spooky reading the phone book. Like, that's what this is.
Yeah. Again, he's doing a good job. And I only have to stress that because literally everyone else is doing a bad job.
Like, I still like what Paula Marshall was doing, but...
I mean, and when it's that consistent, it is absolutely a directorial failure.
Did you ever... For Halloween or when you went trick-or-treating or something like that as a child, go to a place where they had just spooky things on a tape that they were just playing in the background?
Explain.
Like, you can buy spooky tape and it has creepy sounds. And occasionally you would have someone saying creepy things. Doug Bradley, like you could pull that out of this movie, just take his little monologues and put it on a $3 cassette tape.
Oh, okay. And it would just, yeah.
Just play in the background. The secret sound at the center of the world. Like, give me my candy.
I was waiting for someone to say, "Is Vigo?" But he drifts into parody here. And honestly, that's kind of okay for what it is. It's just, I don't like this one. It was a little cringy for me.
Jadzia Dax runs for safety of the streets, because nothing bad could happen out on the streets of New York City. And then we get full-on disaster picture. Power lines break free. Demons control electricity. Hot fire hydrants explode.
This is where it looks like all that stuff from Nightmare 2. So this is where it sucks again real bad. No,
right out in the street. Like, once you leave the boiler room, it's like, what? No. Because you spent so much time and effort making that boiler room super creepy.
Honestly, all of a sudden it looks like that Richard Lester opening to Superman 2, where you're just like, what? Is this a musical? Is it a musical now?
And then we get what, to my mind, is the true betrayal of the whole concept of Hellraiser. Just like, the spirit of it is lost utterly. Once we get the themed Cenobites. I hate them. I hate them so much.
I understand, man.
And I understand the instinct, because I was a child once, and as that child, I saw alien xenomorph action figures. And there were so many different types of alien xenomorph. You could get, like, the dog alien. You get all the different types of aliens. And I'm like, I just want more types. I just want more different versions of the thing. Give me a duck xenomorph. I want to see it.
Little aside, those were all made for a cartoon series that never happened, because after they started doing it, someone went, "Have you seen these movies?"
She's best friends with the queen alien, right? Like, then just they go shopping and have ice cream?
Oh, okay. But the interesting thing is, they just decided, fuck it, with the toys. And so the line was very successful, so they kept making them. Because if you think about it from a marketing place, that's a weird thing to do, right? They're kind of an accidental toy line. Yeah, no, it's the worst.
Doc, the cameraman, has a camera stuck in his face.
I hate it.
The DJ has CDs inserted in his head and can fling them at passerbys as projectiles.
Oh, I hate it.
The bartender has his face covered in barbed wire. Because barb. He breathes fire and has cocktail shakers that are like Molotov cocktails. Ha, 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 ho.
It's like an early 90s absolute ad. It's just,
the lack of imagination is stunning.
These people, it's really simple, because I'm almost not making an analysis of this movie. I'm just saying the things I would say about A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, because it's the exact same stuff. These people wanted to make another movie. Fine, great, capitalism. They wanted to make another movie because this was a successful movie that was cheap. Okay, great, capitalism.
They purposely excised the source of the imagination because they thought he would lose the money. Okay, capitalism. All right.
Yeah, sure. All right. I guess. I mean, it's exactly the same story. Hey, Mr. Craven, we'd like you to make a sequel to this movie. I don't really think that movie's like a sequel-y kind of movie. Yeah, I'm not going to do that. Okay. Oh my God, that was a train wreck. Yeah, I told you it wasn't really sequel-y. Will you make us a third one? Yeah, it'll be great, I guess, but geez.
Jadzia Dax runs away from themed Cenobites into a church. A friendly priest doesn't believe in demons until Pinhead proves him otherwise.
Why?
Cause.
Why?
I get the feeling someone involved in this, maybe the director, maybe a producer, someone who is on set, is a lapsed Catholic and just wanted some Catholic imagery in there. It's like, oh, Pinhead's gonna grab a cross and it's gonna melt.
This doesn't make sense to me, artistically.
Take out brain worms from his skull and pierce both his palms like the crucifixion. He's gonna, a dark parody of our Lord and Savior. Like, somebody had a brilliant idea on set. And you know what? Maybe even this is Clive Barker. This actually feels like the kind of Baroque Clive Barker thing that he would make them put in for just one scene, if I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, maybe, but it would also, you're probably right.
And what's great about it is it's kind of a punishment. It's kind of like, oh, you didn't want me to be Clive Barker, but now you need me? Well, I'm going to just Clive Barker all over the place. In fact, yeah, I think Clive Barker is that lapsed Catholic.
Oh, you want me to come back? Yeah, all your contract terms. Man, we're sorry. We're so sorry all of that happened. All right, I'm going to need a gay priest. And when we edit this, I don't want to edit out all the times.
Look, this is what I'm going to do.
We just stopped to say it's a terrible movie.
This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to edit out all the times that you've said it's a terrible movie. But my gift to you is just a supercut of all the times you've said it's a terrible movie. Jadzia Dax runs into a construction site. Let's get a couple more themed Cenobites, because we don't have enough. There's JP with bizarre pistons firing in his skull, because I guess that...
Why?
I think it's sexual, but it's the least sexual thing that's ever been involved in a Cenobite. Like...
All right, well, we want his to be real sexual, so, like, do something fucked up and dark, and that's all the other Cenobites already.
Like, everything about them is bondage gear, yeah.
Okay, well, maybe, like, sleek and, like, open, evocative of vaginas. Yeah, again, every other Cenobite already. All right, just give him a piston.
And this is the saddest thing. Poor Cenobite Terry. They just didn't have a theme for her, and so they just, because she smoked a couple times, they like put a cigarette embedded in her throat, tracheotomy style.
It's like they put together these themed monkey paw things for a different movie, where each of these people are being punished for their sins that we learned about. And they were given the opportunity to atone for earlier. But that's not this movie. They forgot to make that movie.
The two Cenobites circle Jadzia Dax in a manner which is specifically not terrifying. There's something very community theater about the way...
They look like the fucking Jets.
That's the first sports reference you've ever thrown out that I...
Oh, no. I meant the Jets and the Sharks.
Oh, they're the Jets. They're the Jets all the way. Okay.
So don't you dare cut a minute of that.
Yes, that makes a lot more sense. Now, I just want to say
that was extraordinary.
The New York Jets are also a terrible horror show that circles pointlessly around and is a waste of everyone's time. So it works.
Yeah, no, as I understand it, no. it looks like the same thing. You're so aware of the set spaces, and it's bad filmmaking. It's not just a bad movie. We've watched some terrible movies where the DP set it up right, and the cameraman had, and you know, some grips lit it properly, and everyone, and then they all looked at each other and went, man, this is a piece of shit. And then they shot it.
You hate Death Race 2000.
I hate Death Race
2000. You hate it. You hate that film. But you got to admit, on every level, from an action set point, from a cinematography set.
Oh, it's beautiful. There's some beautiful parts of that movie. It's incredible. It's incredibly well shot.
Because they know what the money shot is. They know what the people are coming to see. And this...
They clearly do not.
The betrayal is not that they've things up so poorly, although they have. The betrayal... is that when it comes to the part we need from this movie for it to be scary, they're just not even trying from a filmic point of view.
Even remotely.
Yeah. I don't know. You want to make it a little darker so it looks spooky? Nah.
And it's strange to say because the first two movies are so small. They're very intimate films.
And I'd argue that when Hellbound opens up the world, that's the mistake it makes, is trying to make the world bigger.
I completely agree. And it's hard to see that retroactively, because, of course, now that there's this sprawling Hellraiser universe, now it makes perfect sense that there's this lore that you really want to breathe in.
But when there's two, we could have had a lot more fun in those tiny movies where we have the edges of things. I mean, for me, what I love most about those first two movies is they're almost Lovecraftian.
Well, yeah, because it's about a threshold. It's about things coming through the threshold, yeah. and trying to bring you back with them. And they exist on that other side in a way that is inhuman and cannot be understood by our pitiful minds. Yeah.
I mean, even sort of the suspension of disbelief is just aided by the idea that, like, within 10 seconds of watching the first movie, I understand that the beings I am seeing on the screen are representations of something bigger and different and crazy. By this movie, they're just dudes.
By making it part of our world, it makes it so small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, I really, again, it was such a surprise just because I kind of thought I knew what Hellraiser was. And I was 50% right. But those first two movies are, I love those movies now.
I honestly am interested to hear your thoughts when we get to Hellraiser 5 and 6. If only because I have watched both of those films once, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for both of them, I think I was a little disappointed by the smallness of their scope. But I wonder if now in retrospect, being a little older and having thought about movies more, and horror movies in particular, that's not just the exact right thing that had to happen.
Everybody's got the fiction that works for them. That it's, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's almost the same as what turns you on. You know, like it's weird, and you almost don't have much of a choice in what it's gonna be. And I like those Baroque impressions of a fifth dimensional being shit because I can trust a good author. Then we've hung enough lattice work that I'm like, if you don't give me any reason to doubt the reality, I'll let you go. Because you've already told me I can't understand the thing we're talking right. about.
Right.
And yeah, you just threw it away here.
And the idea that what we see in Hellraiser is the tip of an iceberg that we cannot imagine.
Yeah.
That's the scary bit.
Yeah. Just 100%.
Jadzia Dax fiddles with a puzzle box and begins to zap all the baddies, and then suddenly she's in a field with her father in Vietnam, I guess.
Sure.
He asks for the box. This entire scene seems ADR'd. I don't know. She gives her dad the puzzle box, but it's a fake out. She just gave the box to Pinhead. It's too much natural light. It just looks wrong. You can't, like, what? Why couldn't it suddenly turn dark when Pinhead shows up? I don't know. I think they just didn't like filming at night. I think they just found it relaxing to film in the day. They had to do less work.
It is less work. The sun, it turns out, provides a lot of light, so you can just sort of point cameras and stuff.
But this double cross turns into a triple cross because this is Deus Ex Ghost. It's a Doug Bradley face-off. Pinhead versus Ghost Captain Spencer Pinhead Doug Bradley.
And this is the worst thing that happens in this movie.
Really? worse than DJ and Barbie and Doc, the Cenobites?
Hey, I get the feeling that somebody had fun making those fucking things.
Pinhead binds Jadzia Dax in leather. It's like almost as if it kind of remembers that there's a sexual element to Cenobites in this one moment. Oh, we can exploit a lady? Did you know that leather could be sexual?
I wish there was a better way to convey eye rolls in audio. It's just...
Yeah. A weird worm entwined with chains burst through the floor. Maybe it's going to eat her. Maybe it's going to turn her into a Cenobite. Who knows? But just as Jadzia Dax is about to be Cenobited, the Bradleys start to merge in a CGI madness.
Why?
I don't know.
No. In universe, why did that happen at all?
Because being a demon is bad, and being a ghost is bad, but being a ghost demon, it's like a two wrongs make a right. All I know is it's just enough a distraction for Jadzia Dax to escape her leather, turn the puzzle box into an octahedron, and stab Pinhead with it. She's left, breaking out of whatever bizarre dream sequence. Pinhead destroyed utterly. Maybe, theoretically. She's sitting in the construction site where everybody had been a Cenobite not moments ago, and she drops the box into some wet concrete that no one can ever be troubled by it again. Score one for the good guys. Fast forward to some indeterminate time in the future, a fancy office building where this construction site once stood. But the walls look like the puzzle box! The horror!
Is the building the puzzle box now? Is that what they're saying? Are they saying the building has become the puzzle box? Or are they saying it marks the puzzle box? Or are they saying that's...
You're just going to have to watch Hellraiser Bloodlines to find out. Hellraiser 3! The Motorhead's going to start! They're going to play some Motorhead! This movie's over!
On the soul of Lemmy.
Bad enough to besmirch the franchise, but to besmirch Motorhead? For shame. For shame, director Anthony Hickox.
Honestly, I wouldn't even put Night Ranger in this thing.
Maybe a Gibb brother?
One.
No. Not all of the Bee Gees. Just one Bee Gee. You know?
And not even Andy.
No.
I don't think this movie was very good.
Well, the sequel's an Alan Smithy film, so let's, can't wait for four. Boursier, got any plugs?
I do this month, Ben.
What you got?
I have all of the various United Planned Parenthoods, Narrow Pro-Choice America, the National Abortion Federation, the National Organization of Women, and the American Civil Liberties Union. We'll post some links.
That's good. And I am going to do shallow distracting plugs, just because you may well need things to take your mind off of how crappy things are. And if you do, I suggest The Black Phone. That was a really fun horror movie based on a Joe Hill short story given to you by the director of Hellraiser Inferno, which we will eventually watch. So that's a fun little connection. Also, I'll do Umbrella Academy. I really like season 3 of Umbrella Academy. It was a fun time.
I did too. I watched that, so I can agree. Again, you and I think we're of the same mind. At the end of season 2, it looked like it was kind of running out of steam.
A little sloppy, a little all over the place a bit. But no, I feel like they really righted the ship in season 3.
Yeah, season 3 was very strong. Season 3 was very, very strong. And you know what? More than in other seasons, a lot of very strong performances. Mm-hmm. The show, I feel like, has always hung together well, but, you know, some of the actors just weren't given a lot of material to work with. And I think someone was very careful to go through and make sure that everybody got their moment this season.
So from two of the bungled to all our botched friends out there, we love you.
We do. And if you type in Beatnik Werner Herzog poodle.
Oh my god, what happens? What happens when you type that in?
All you get is watch Klaus Nomi debut his new wave vaudeville show.
That actually, you know what? That sounds really right.
Klaus Nomi. Yes, watch Klaus Nomi debut his new wave vaudeville show, The Birth of the Opera Singing Space Alien, 1978.
I want to know where the poodle comes in.
But I'm just going to leave it be.